Thank you, Jill. Thank you, everyone. Really glad to be here. Because this is the opening event, I've got to start with two poems about poetry. And the first one is a brand new poem, which I've not read before, which also feels right, beginning the festival. So I was commissioned to write a poem about a non-alphabetical character, and I chose the ampersand. And the first thing I thought I was going to do was make a visual poem, but instead I decided to kind of riff off John Donne's The Flea and create a kind of metaphysical argument for the use of the ampersand in poetry. Behind it all is a visual poem, if you like, the idea of the ampersand on the page as a flea. And it's called The Ampersand Flea, and it begins with a quote from John Donne. Wherein could this flea guilty be, except in that drop which it sucked from thee? Mark but this and mark in full script, saw something of ourselves in it before it bit, sucked on Blake's amniotic blood until the call was a cut worm's hood, nipped, dual-pronged into the white, drunk then fled into fetish night. Icon of symbol and pressed text, compressed in tired knot of syntax, brought your eye to see in the compact. Three lines in one and two letters spare, like a bald babe curled up bare. This and is you and this and is I, locked like a 69 on a marriage bed, twin fizz pins of wine, this maverick love our parents grudged, that cloistered in a motorway travel lodge. Or and, a medieval torture trick, for knuckles buckled in its black, our fingers linked in the gold of wedlock. Then you said, why not just use the and? And while you're there, make all rhymes end evenly around where the and would be, and file down the finicles of the and for me. Yet we agree that being together is stronger than any visual character. But in that first poem, the knit of the and bit your eye like light from sand in one looped stroke that flew my hand. Now this poem is also about poetry, a very different poem. It's the first poem in my collection, Speculatrix, which, if it has a theme, it's about watching and being watched. Speculatrix is a Latin word for a female spy. It's completely surprising to me that word's fallen out of usage. What I love about it is there's something futuristic of it in its sound, speculatrix. So it's a word waiting to be realised, if you like. And this first poem, it's called Black Lodge Recorder, and it comes from David Lynch's Twin Peaks. There's the Black Lodge, basically, which is an extra-dimensional space that includes a red room. Anyone who's seen Twin Peaks will remember this very bizarre place. And I love this as a kind of metaphor for poetry, you know, a space that you go into and it has its usage while you read the poem. And then it's like, you know, kind of, what was that all about? And there's this moment in Twin Peaks where after Laura Palmer's been killed and the detective's looking for the murderer, they find a minor bed. And the minor bird is speaking what seems to be the final moments of Laura Palmer's life, this very violent scene. And as the bird's speaking, it gets shot through the window. But luckily for Agent Cooper, it's being recorded at the same time. And I kind of think some poems want to be the minor bird and some poems want to be the tape recorder. Black Lodge recorder. A black box is a device which has input and output mechanisms. Its internal workings are unknown. It is of the starling family and can often be heard saying, Leo, no. Almost anything can be described as a black box, even the human mind. It is distinct for its wattled feet. The opposite of a black box is a snow warbler chirruping in porcelain. The death of a black box is often used in avant-garde TV dramas to set the tone for the series, ludic but chilling. Most black boxes now come pre-installed with Syrinx V6. Although these devices are omnivores, eating mainly insects and fruit, their blood is redder than expected when it drips on an open box of donuts. Humans, to pacify their lust for displayed intelligence, often attribute black boxes with names such as Waldo. Most species nest in holes, so cages expose them to things they can't forget. Lyra, Lyra, don't go there. Sometimes they repeat these things, hurting me. Later models have developed extravagant face masks as if to remain anonymous. They have two eyes that turn clockwise to record, and the voice licks itself strapped to black spools. Even when the black box is shot with a bullet, its voice remains captured. Stop it, Leo, no. Although called a black box is actually bright orange to make location easier after a disaster. The orange is the same colour as a minor bird's beak. And moving on from poetry to the people who make it, I'm really pleased to be joining in with English Pen's project called Poetry as Protest, where they've hooked up poets coming to the festival with poets at risk from around the world. And I've been paired up with a Cameroonian poet called Eno Mayomese. And I'd like to read a poem by him. He was in prison for 3.5 years and he was released in April this year. And this poem's called Why Do You Treat Me Like This? Why do you treat me like this? Simply because I don't see things your way. Have you not freed words? Have you not freed spirits? Have you not freed souls? Have you not freed tongues? O leaders of this regime, custodians of my people's destiny, why do you treat me like this? Simply because I don't see things your way. And that was translated by Dick Higgins. I'm going to read a poem which is coming out of that, really, in the sense of languages. And it's from a book published by the brilliant Nan Archers. It's kind of inspired by just the sheer fact that London has over 300 languages spoken every day. And it's called What the Courier Knows. 3,011 interpreters along Whitehall. 20,586 translators in the city. 152 actuaries on the short stretch of Norton Folgate. 12,701 code makers for bank credits in Shoreditch. 1,298,402 serotonin uplifters portholed in blister packs. 312 languages in one metropolis. Owners of numerical systems and job descriptions. 98,919 strip owners of Visa in Chelsea. 156,983 signature scrolls across unsecured cheques in Southwark. 102,101 Blackberries like handheld cabs across Docklands. 50,241 underarm toxins on Commercial Road. 11,001 hotel swipe cards in Bloomsbury. 34,789 coiled ring pulls on the Isle of Dogs. 27,703 ex-East Enders in Dagenham. 3,412 SIM cards plasticised inside Canary Wharf. 742 new fragments of poetry on notebooks across 33 boroughs. 8,041 units of ethanol consumed on Charing Cross Road. 600 feet obsolete graffitis on the old Kent Road. 30,312 minutes of conversations exchanged for Bill Tariff on Denmark Street. I love you, spoken 989 times. 401 therapists in Golders Green. 748,060,099 bones of the non-living weaving the Thames shoreline. 312 languages, tongues like skinned dogs. I'm going to come back to Speculatrix and sticking with the London theme. At the heart of the book is a series of poems inspired by Jacobean drama. Each one is spoken by a character from a Jacobean play. I had this idea that the poems would be set at the venue for the first London performance of that play, and the players were almost coming out on the street and acting out the emotions of the plays for real. Any more to say about that? The language, I guess just the language, it moves about between Jacobean language, which I was really inspired by. Just the very idea of the playwrights being poets, the language not being set, being invented as they write almost, and the collaborative energy which goes into these plays as well. I'm going to read a few of these. The first being, we'll go with The White Devil, I think, to begin with, Webster's play. And it's spoken by the Duke of Bracciano, who visits the house of Camillo with the intention of seducing Camillo's wife, Vittoria Corombona. Vittoria allows Bracciano to visit her, and she gives him a jewel. Camillo is killed by Bracciano's secretary, Flaminio, in what is staged to be a vaulting accident. Vittoria was put on trial for Camillo's death and sentenced to a house of convertites. We are here, Clerkenwell, 1612. Late nights around the eyes, claws of blackbirds, woke three times to configure double negatives, air sat sleep translucent. In the dearth of winter, this audience has less wit than sparrows. Ears ball player, whose side are you on? You're no Bill Shankly. Never share one madness with another. It's subjective therapy and blood on your shoes. Void out the earth and scatter our bones. Do it at the Red Bull Clerkenwell, where the hedge funders took our players, seized our seats. We want back what's rightfully ours, our concessions on tragedy. Don't paint yourself white. It washes the rain like London clay down gutters of mush petticoats. We are brave, the stars with several kinds of light. And if there's a white devil, there's a black star, drawing us to the river's marshes, after hours, straining itself into the Thames of Blackfriars. The zombies of ambition never come here. These hours belong to us. When the pit has moshed us by syntax, when the language we have paid for has made us sweat, and all that is left is to make our bodies act out the desires they now have words for, images of us now subtitled in a way most modern. Don't paint yourself white until you're running white inside, in the way the poet forewarns us. If you say you don't want it, you want it. This is the double negative of the flesh, which the brain in its maggot folds idly watches. It has nothing to hatch. There is no choice. The Changeling, spoken by Alcimero, who has fallen in love with Beatrice. As she is already betrothed to Alonso, he gives up hope. The Flores, manservant to her mother, also loves her. Isabella uses the Flores to kill Alonso, who presents her with the ring finger of the corpse as evidence and takes her chastity as payment. Now free to marry Isabella, Alcimero wants to test her virginity, but Isabella swaps places with her maidservant, Diophanta, on her wedding night. When Diophanta doesn't come out from the bedchamber, Beatrice asks the Flores to start a fire and then kill Diophanta in the confusion. Confronted, Beatrice confesses all to Alcimero. We are here, unknown London location, 1624. Out of the cockpit, aureolas of ash, riots run in cycles, Drury Lane cleansed by midnight fire, blue ribbons of smoke over King William Street, walled in your scent. Exclam, text from the back of a cab, pending the morning's phrase search. Exclam means the ruse of Google, so fucking literal. Did you mean exclaim? Here we are, too soon for the dictionary, too late for referral. The pending book, just a system bereft of Thanatos, the rose anagram Eros. Before the paradox of the phoenix, a conflagration of shadows and brain-sick patients morph in the flames like red cellophane fish. If the heads and tails move, the fortune paper says, we're both in love. The bricks combust in reflexes. Beatrice, your reflexes combust. The last trick of death I read, fuck its attraction. This hoodwinked eiderdown of smoke, we come up for air in the great serotonin come down of 1622. All we want is water and each other. The buses in kindled blocks of red, we both have a smouldered city inside us that is the same. I know the great fire is yet to come. It will not alter us. My heart, a splenetic flame, cindering ribs to crust, taking out the zombies of ambition. They will rebuild the same lines to walk us down, these dead, concocting dictionaries, defining madness. We could have this conversation at the door of any tavern at any time, but it's tonight in this thirst, this first combustion. I hadn't planned to read this poem, but I had a fantastic conversation with George before the event about a mutual idol, I guess, it's fair to say. He's, in my mind, the greatest book artist of the late 20th century. That's brilliant, Ron King. And I absolutely admire his work. And you take the chance to try and find it out. He makes books which are like theatre. It's hard to explain, but they include kind of puppets and secret chambers and all kinds of things that you wouldn't imagine could go into a book. And what I found about getting to know Ron a little bit is how he's experienced a really tragic and quite traumatic life. And I wrote this poem after visiting him at his house and asked permission from him to publish it later, which he gave to me. It's called Ron King at the Estuary. Ron King walks to the estuary and tells me of his son. Ron King walks me to the estuary and tells me of his son's death. Ron King walks me to the estuary and tells me of his son's death to cancer. Ron King walks me to the estuary and tells me his son's name was Daniel. Ron King walks me to the estuary and tells me of Daniel's death to cancer. The book artist Ron King tells me that his next son died years later of the same cancer. The great book artist Ron King tells me that his son had turned to God and thought God could cure him. The greatest book artist of the 20th century, Ron King, tells me that God has punished him for his house and success. In Ron King's book, Bluebeard's Castle, there is a room that contains a last door. His eye was changed to the eye. God is in ellipsis, the water below, a fishtail, a white rowboat, a low-flying swallow. On the shore of the estuary, there are mounds of algae drying in the sun like the pages of a book. Thank you for listening.
Hello, event number one. I'm going to do that because it won't be the same if you can't see my knees. You should never start an event with an apology, which is what I'm about to do, but I would like to apologise to those of you who were expecting to see my knees a little while ago at the launch of the actual festival and who didn't. Sorry, Chloe, if I nearly gave you a heart attack. I was examining the psychogeography of the M5 for some time. It's very nice to be sandwiched between Chris McCabe and George Surtees. That's the only time I expect to say that sentence. You never know, the night is young. But it's especially wonderful to be here on this side of the microphone at Ledbury and seeing what that clock looks like at last and watching it closely. We have been paired, as Chris said, most of us, with poets by English pen, and these are poets who are at risk, really, in one way or another. I don't know if Chloe knew when she paired me with Zairing Wosa that I'm not Buddhist, but Buddhish, as my friend Hugh would say, and so I'm very pleased and proud to read a poem by the Tibetan poet Zairing Wosa. A sheet of paper can become a knife. A sheet of paper can become a knife, a rather sharp one too. I was only turning the page when the ring finger of my right hand got sliced at the knuckle. Though small, the sudden wound oozed blood, a thread as fine as silk, and stung a little. Startling transformation from paper into knife. There must have been some mistake or some kind of turning point. This ordinary paper, a chill of awe. Because poetry is witchcraft, yeah. Poetry does make things happen and is one of the great forces that does it. And I wanted to carry on that theme from Zähring's poem with a little bit of impertinence into the first poem of my book, which is called Crates, and which continues that idea that poets can make anything into anything. And we're all poets when we listen as well as when we speak. So this is called Crates. Observe that when I speak of crates, your mind supplies one straight away. Likely, you are thinking of the fruiterer's crate, a shallow, slattered box of rain-napped pine, the archetype of apples stenciled on the side, a cartouche slot above it for a grocer's hand. Your crate may be the sturdy plastic tub of the eco-minded council, waiting at the gate with all its rinsed tomato cans and, in this case, a drowned frog. Or, then again, the solid, beer-smooth wood hefted by the publican with its hungover slump of bottles to the yard the morning after. Your crate exists as soon as it is thought. Its shape is shown in speaking of it. Now, let us speak of love. There are lots of different kinds of love. I normally write about the sordid sort, which I'm sure you've all been looking forward to, but almost uniquely this set is going to be terribly highbrow. Hear the sighs of disappointment. However, I wouldn't want you to think that I'd changed completely. So this is a little poem about ducks. Yes, yeah, some of you know what's coming, as it were. Has anyone seen ducks having intercourse? No. It is a vile and disgusting act, ladies and gentlemen, and they are not courteous. The gentlemen are not, anyway. If I move this up, Stuart, will your ears explode? No. Okay. Is that better? Yeah. So this is called Oiks, and there's nothing a British audience on a hot summer's evening likes more than audience participation. So this is just to make sure that you're still awake. It's only event number one. There's another... How many to go, Chloe? Oh, that's a mean thing to ask you on the first night. Over 70. Come on, we're in here for the long haul. So, I'm going to give you a line. You are playing the part of ducks in this poem. And when I say, what do we want? Your answer is, bread! When do we want it? Now! And you're going to say that three times. Now, and now, and now. You'll know. Oiks. The walk may be Churchillian, chin in and belly first. You don't fool me, you water cockney mallards with your nightclub swagger. I've seen you fucking in the shallows, shouting like a bus stop drunk. Your drab and scrawny twockers cruising for an open door. On patrol and on the ante, cocky as the little ships, common as muck. Over here, lads, there's some bird with a sandwich. Don't give us plate-scraped lettuce, couscous, scraps of rocket, for fuck's sake. We want bread and none of your granary shit. What do we want?
Bread.
When do we want it? Now. And now. And now. Lunchtime, you're hungover, slouching on the bank and muttering. At midnight, up for anything. A new tattooed, that stripe of Primark colour on each wing. That old-fashioned gang rape every spring. She's down. Get in. You know, there's that lovely poetry noise where people go, People never know what noise to make at the end of that poem. But quite often they go, ooh. I was asked to make a poem, I am the canal laureate, behold my crown of duckweed. And I get defrocked in September, which I'm very much looking forward to. And I was asked to write a poem about locks for a project with Alistair Cook, who makes wonderful film poems. You can Google this film poem, Lifted, and you'll see a film that goes with it. And I shall tell you a secret, which is that when you see the film, which is supposedly of a boat going up in a lock, if other way around, going down in a lock, if you look at the sides of the screen, you will see the little water droplets going up, because we actually went down and he had to film it the other way around, so he just reversed the film. So you should be able to work a lock on the narrow canals after hearing this. Lifted. The land says, come uphill. And water says, I will, but take it slow. A workman's ask and nothing fancy, will you? Here's an answer, engineered, a leisurely machine, a box of oak and stone, the mitred lock, the waters. Yes. We're stopped. The bow bumps softly at the bottom gate and drifts. All water wants, all water ever wants, is to fall. So we use the fall to lift us, make of water its own tool, as simple as a crowbar or a well-tied knot. Open up the paddles, let it dam and pucker, lift, and with it lift us like a bride, a kite, a wanted answer, breath no longer held, or like a boat. We're on our way and rising. Water rushes in like fools. These tonnages that slip across the sill, all dirty bottle green and gathering into a giddy hurl, then slower, slow, until it ends in glassy bulges, hints of aftermath, a cool and thorough spending. Wait, then, for the shudder in the gate, the backward drifting boat that tells you there and here are equal, an imbalance righted. Ask of water, help me rise. And water says, I will. The problem with writing about canals is nothing happens very fast. And if you read all your poems at 3 miles an hour, people get a bit bored and stop falling asleep. So this one might wake you up a bit, as it woke me up a bit. A narrowboat, as you probably know, has a completely flat bottom. It's got no keel. And so a seagoing boat, when it meets a current, can tip over to 90 degrees and right itself. A narrowboat has 15 degrees of play and then you're stuffed. So crossing the Bristol Channel in it would be a really stupid thing to do. This is a poem about the day I crossed the Bristol Channel. We didn't quite cross it. We came out, if you can imagine the geography, we came out of Bristol to Avonmouth. And then turned left to Portishead, as if to America, which was very disturbing. And then the following morning, you turn out of that lock and turn right for Gloucester. And there are jellyfish and mermaids and krakens in the water, and Wales is 5 miles away, and it's as close to going to sea as you will ever find yourself doing in a narrowboat. A crossing. The harbour wall that cupped us like a hand around a lighter flame is gone. We're out and running with the tide, the tide, the tide, for Christ's sake, with a cargo of small selves. My boat. My boudica of the tomato plants and golf umbrellas. Pushing for the other side at dawn. My grubby whippet, slender as a sighthound. Tinker puts her rusted muscles to the test. Fights 7 like a ratter. Through the slime road, where the currents slide across the hidden spits, nose up in foam as if 100 feet of water were her usual 3, and leaping glassy spinners, throttles up to dash between the stanchions of white bridges thrown across her path, my golden hind of red geraniums, my lively flea, my tractor-engined slipshod craft, my ploughshare, cutting furrows to the entrance gate. We're in! 7 turns away. The grey gate swings. The Gloucester and Sharpness is ready, lays a 16-foot glass slipper at our feet. Tinker ties up with a tugman's hitch and settles in the company of swans where she belongs. It's all sweet water now. Her skipper, missing sleep, will wake at 3 and walk the towpath naked, toes as soft as crab flesh on the earth, finding herself thirsty again, tilting back her throat for want of salt. I can't compete with Chris's knowledge of Jacobean playwrights. Nor should I, since he's already written that book. But I have a passing interest in Renaissance painters because they're stroppy buggers and they change the world, not just in terms of painterly perspective, but in terms of how a working man can be perceived and how we can change boundaries, how permeable class boundaries can be. So this is about Giotto, who was a stroppy bugger of the Renaissance type, and it's called Infallible. True story, this. Outside the workshop, toddlers tumbled by. "They sent me here for beauty," said the courtier. "Your children are so plain." Giotto laughed, a blacksmith's laugh. "I made them in the dark," he said. "Took you a minute, but you got there." The envoy blushed, unsealed his errand. "His Holiness commands a sample of your work." "Indeed," said Giotto. "We will talk as soon as Pietro's roof is done." The messenger leaned in and scowled. "The Holy Father's business is to speak for God." Giotto snatched the scroll, returned it with a circle, compass perfect, in a single sweep of red. "God speaks for himself," he said. Three more. Yeah. And now the bit where you sing. Oh God, they say it's only event one and already they're asking us to sing. There are only two more after this, I promise you. So this is called Raising the Roof for Kirsty. Perhaps one more after this, actually, looking at the clock. Raising the Roof for Kirsty is called, and it's about my friend Kirsty, who lives on the banks of the Severn in a fantastic chapel. And when you finish the roof on a building, you have a topping out ceremony, and you hoist a tree, really, to the tip of the roof to show that you've completed it. And then you all get very drunk. So your lines, ladies and gentlemen, I want to imagine that you're very, very glad that you've just finished a roof. "The roof is finished, the roof is finished." That's your line, you know? Imagine how glad you are to sing it. Okay, so, with uplifted minds and glad hearts, "The roof is finished, the roof is finished." Thank you. And there is another line later on which we'll pick up as we go along. "Raising the roof for Kirsty, praise your 1,000 days of busted knuckles, backache, neckache, dusted wire wool hair, of eating cheese amongst the rubble, reading Heaney in your Wellingtons, and never a clean dress to go dancing in. Praise the day we gathered at your door to hoist a pine branch to the eaves and sang a ruddy choir under your paint stick baton. The roof is finished, the roof is finished, till we were hoarse enough for beer and flames, drank each other to a charcoal drowse, settling in half-wrapped corners, here a one and there a swaddled pair. Easy on the floor as hounds inside a mead hall, stationed to sleep out the hours of thunder. And as water found a way between the pitchy ridge and roof slates, sending piss-thin streams to wet the flagstones by her head, praise the one, whichever one it was, who, laughing in half-sleep, got up and put the kettle on." Began the chorus that we took up, one by one. "The roof is leaking. The roof is leaking. The roof is leaking." Waking, placing buckets, drinking tea hungover. And what's a song for Kirsty anyway, if not to keep the roof on? I'm going to finish with this. I apologise if I have overrun. I can't tell because the clock and my watch are substantially different. But I apologise if I have. This is the title poem of the book. The idea of kith is that when we speak of kith and kin are the people you're related to and you have to spend bloody Christmas with. Kith are the people you actually like, or who, it's not as easy as that actually. Kith means the known. It means the people who know you, which is not always the same as the people you like. But in this room, with these people, I feel this is the right poem to finish with. It's called Kith. A word made scant by frequent use. I like it for its urgency and spit, for its necessity. I like it for its oldness, for its slingshot certainty. I like it for its plainness, for belonging to the northern tongue behind my teeth. I like it for its fighting talk, the known, the tribe. Something I can recognise, something that recognises me. I am not who I think I am, but who you know me to be.
Hello. I read from four books. I read from the two last books and the two books which are to come. I'll begin with a poem called The Thirst is By the Way, since I'm a kind of afterthought in this particular reading. I wasn't given a poet to pair with, so my apologies to the unknown poet to whom I might have been paired. The Thirties. It was the 30s once again. Shop doors opened on hunger and long queues for soup. The poor, clothed by the same half-empty stores, stood round in doorways in a ragged group. The unemployed were drunk in railway stations. Rumours of war played on a constant loop. The Furies were running out of patience, reduced to muttering curses, and the lost were lost in their own preoccupations. In feral offices, the running cost of living was calculated down to pence by those who needed least and owned the most. Imperial glamour was the last defence. The cinema played all-out games of doom on borrowed power. Even our dreams were dense, crowding us out of every empty room. We threw each other out for lack of rent. We were the bust remains of what was boom. And knowing this, that none of it was meant, not quite precisely as the world turned out, but as a fanciful presentiment, was of no consolation. None could doubt what was happening. The sea was emptiness out of which light emerged. One distant shout, and it was here. The waters, fancy dress of time as tide, the crowds along the street jostling to hear a demagogue's address. Where else was all the troubled world to meet? Why was the water rushing to the door? At whose damp walls were the loud waves to beat? That's from a forthcoming book. It'll forthcome sometime in 2017. This is from a previous book. This is from The Burning of the Books, which is a series of 14 poems based upon a novel by Elias Canetti, in which there's a scholar, there's a dwarf, there's a book collection. This one is primarily about money and having lots of it. This is the book collector. We are in his library. Once she had passed over the kid gloves, and a book appeared with its antiquary bloom, its insect words pinned into place with light. It was clear there was expense involved. Expense and respect and a question of property. I don't deal with property. I am a scholar. I don't do housekeeping. I don't do money. I did a round of the bookshops, interrogating dealers with rare editions in long-lost languages. I've circumnavigated the alleys of Vienna more often than I can remember, but I recall perfectly the place of each book on each shelf and have marked its neighbours and condition. Money is air. I breathe it in and out. I blow my nose clear of it. I piss it in the morning and last thing at night. Money is a slight breeze playing around my temples as I enter the shop, the slight draft at the back of my neck as I leave it. It is a whisper of fallen leaves in the gutter, the rustle half dry and half damp of a system in decay. Pass me the kid gloves. I'm handling a book. The words of the dead are settling over me. I drift among them, weightless, like a balloon floating on helium, looking down on gutters overflowing with leaves and paper money. I don't see the difference. This is from a book which will come out sometime this year. It's called Notes on the Inner City. And it has essentially come out of tweets, really. These tiny little texts, which for me have begun to form themselves into series. This is The Boy King's Tale, and it kind of follows that sort of oddly political sort of note of the first two poems. The Boy King's Tale. Off with his head, screamed the queen. And his. And his. And then other ones. I don't trust heads. I don't like your nose. The boy at the queen's side took out his catapult and shot the man's nose off. It was his first act in a dynasty. The space where the man's nose had been was a vacancy that should have been filled. A man without a nose is an offence, said the queen. The queen died. The noseless man's head was impaled on a pole. All was well in the kingdom. Now the boy was on the throne. The ghost of the noseless man hovered around the palace corridors. The boy king had it arrested for nothing less than treason. The generals of the army all had noses, but some noses were bigger than others. A degree of consistency was required. All the generals were sheared off their noses by a royal order. Their faces were an offence to a boy king. He sheared them off their heads. More ghosts crowded the palace. The boy king had them arrested. His catapult became the state emblem. The people are hungry, reported the cowering messenger. The boy prince sheared off his nose, then his head. Feed them to the people, he said. The people rose against the boy king. He had them arrested and decapitated. My people are ghosts, he said, to no one in particular. This is from Bad Machine. It's a slightly crazy poem called Colours. For many years, really for 9, 10 years, I wrote lots and lots of sonnets about colour, all different colours. I was fascinated by the things. This is about the names of colours. It's essentially two sonnets, but the first half is just colour names, most of which I've invented. There are a couple of real ones in there. So, Burleywood, Chartreuse, Gainsborough, Ghost White, Greenberg, Maroon, Orchid, Mocassin, Peru, Demosthenes, Snow, Papaya Whip, Popper, Peach Puff, Hot Pink, Hot Hot, Dark Red, Dark Grey, Dodger Blue, Drudger Reed, Derrida, Fuchsia, Fondle, Fricassee, Firebrick, Fenfall, Coral, Corn, Silk, Crimson, Coleridge, Coolidge, Honeydew, Hellebore, Hartshorn, Honegger, Jet, Jellyby, Lavender Blush, Lascar, Light Cyan, Light Light, Grey, Grey-Green, Garrulous, Golightly, Garrick, Indignant, Insolence, Irked, Ivory, Ilk, Jeremiad, Asclepius, Goldenrod, Erivist, Glock, Cyan, Chocolate, Cadet Blue, Camisole, Fallen Grey, Flecked, Lost Blue, Amaretto, Shrubbery, Yearning, Absinthe, Abstinence, Grey Holes in Green.
I'll leave that there. Oh. You like colours. Now, this is a poem written as I love strange and abstruse forms. It's a kind of kinkiness, I suppose. There I'll be. Rithka. Excuse me a second. You don't need to know all this stuff. It's more for me to work with and for you to be thinking about. But there's a lovely poem by Theodore Lethke, American poet, which is a love poem, which begins, "I knew a woman lovely in her bones, and when she moved more ways than one." There's a kind of fantasy on that, and the poem will be clear. Well, you'll hear the repetitions. There are lots of repetitions. When she moved more ways than one. But it's just movement as the cat performs, beauty enough for cats, for anyone. Because a movement can be more than one, and several is how they spent the day. And she was several, far more than one, just more perhaps of one than anyone in terms of movement. Nothing standing still for long enough, though they themselves stood still while moving on, refusing just a one mode of movement or fixity of place, and so they kept on moving place to place. And this is where they were. This was the place where she was moving, every movement one with the next, each fitting into place, then shifting on, discarding sense of place. And he stood by, seeing how grace performs itself and knows its place beyond the place provided for it, never the perfect place. You love the many and you love the one, but many may be focused into one. You want the thing, you want it in a place, you want it how you want it, to be still as poised, he thought, and constant as it's still in movement, loving all that remains still in her, her sense of being in a place, not of it. And the sense he made was still a point of stillness in her being still. So when she moved, it was more ways than one, he noted, as she moved by being still. One might move so and yet remain quite still, he said. It's life that holds her and performs a daily ritual she herself performs. And she performs herself beyond the one still moment of performance in a day that moves past her and will not spare a day. But this was where she moved, it being day she moved through, as though perfectly at one with day, and it with her day after day, with nights to come, the body of the day turning to sleep, an image in the place they lay and moved in a dream of day, working its way through body in a day, as though her body, his dream and day were one. Most time is timeless. Time knows only one mode of being, rushing through the day, ticking of items, a function. It performs performable, but not what she performs. They were, he thought, what permanence performs, when permanence is saved for just one day. So day performs, so anything performs itself by moving, being what performs. Because performance is like standing still while moving. And so everything performs, movement, stillness, whatever thing performs, whatever happens. And it happens in this place or that, the whole being, only the place she moves in, and by moving in, performs. So she, he thought, must clearly be the one who holds a movement still, as if it one with both the stillness and the movement, one moment here or there, then the whole place, her body moved, and then she stopped quite still, still as the world compacted into day, as several parts and all that day performs. I'll read you two more poems. This is another one from those series. This is all about Hercule Poirot and a case he's trying to solve. The trouble is he doesn't quite know what the case is, and nor does he know where he is. So this is Hercule Poirot. Hercule Poirot disappears. There was no one in the street. There was no one in the house. Where were they? Where was the car? What had happened to the plot? The plot was beside the point. The plot was to remain plotless. He opened a box left behind from the last plot. Nothing there. An empty box was no clue. He checked his notebook. It was brand new. He took his pen and wrote a few random words that might mean something. The street was indecipherable. That much was clear. But was it pointless to think so? That was what the words said. He wrote more words. The mystery of the empty street was no less mysterious than the empty house. No car appeared, though it was what the plot required. He thought back to the time he had spent by the sea. There had been gulls and pebbles. Such things had a point and might add up to a plot. The instruments had been well hidden. That is, if they were instruments. He took a key from his pocket. All he needed was a door. The sea was at the door, but the door was elsewhere. He wrote more words. He imagined the door. There was a smell of the sea to consider. Somewhere in the attic lay the clue to the whereabouts of the house. Once he had located the house, he was sure to find the sea. Was there any point in having a key if there were no door? That remained to be discovered. Life is plotless, he decided. He must invent one. The smell of the sea remained. That did not have to be invented. He wrote the word, the sea, in his notebook. The sea was a point. The point was a crime of which the corpse was the result. The corpse was in the car that remained to be invented. The sea was real enough. The sea at least was real. It always had been. His notebook said so. The door must be nearby. He had the key. He was master of the situation. And I'll finish with this poem called Among Animals. This too was originally sort of conceived in the middle of the night on his excursions into Twitter. And there's a series of haikus, and I've been working on those for a long time. But I became very interested in animals, particularly animal consciousness, one's relationship to animals, and so forth. Among animals. Touch the animals in your head. They bend to you, gently, as the food. They shuffle along from arc to arc, obedient as your own shadow. You feed the creatures with the pity they inspire your imagined tribe. The domestic cat that winds its body around you and lives in your throat. The tame dog you feed, that is your several limbs and your lifted head. And all the wild beasts in your eyes, what will you do with them while you sleep? Here's the stuffed giraffe of your childhood and long neck. Here's its faint smile. Here's the caged bird you spent such hours talking to. Will it now talk back? The inhabitants of your body have gathered in herds to hear you. What would you say? Now your languages have failed you and your eyes are lost. Creatures construct you. The world put you together as its quaint puzzle. Now you dismantle the night. Now you call the dark to its vast kennel. Your territory is crowded with animals that go their own ways. Behold your creatures, says the book of the body. Converse with your tribe. Thank you. Thank you very much.